The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. $6 trillion. That's the bottom line of the 2022 federal budget that the Biden administration proposed on Friday. Included in it are the two infrastructure proposals that President Biden has already begun to outline for the public in his American Jobs Plan and American Families Plan. Speaking in Cleveland on Thursday, the president once again detailed what he's hoping to accomplish through these spending measures.
This is already clear. We're on the right track. The American Rescue Plan laid a strong foundation for a new economy that brings everybody along. But it's just the first step. We're going to build on the incentive and incredible progress that we've made and set America on a sustainable path to faster, more inclusive economic growth. We have to start investing in ourselves again, in the American people again.
But for Republican lawmakers, there's another number included in this budget proposal that is likely to draw widespread condemnation. $1.8 trillion. That's the projected size of the federal deficit in 2022 under this plan. And according to the New York Times, debt as a share of the U.S. economy would reach record highs by 2024 if this budget is enacted. Meanwhile, some members of the GOP are trying to negotiate with the Biden administration on infrastructure spending. But the $928 billion plan put out by Republicans this week was quickly criticized by Senate Democrats, who said the GOP is just setting President Biden up to fail. And the partisan divide wasn't just on display this week when it came to the federal budget. On Tuesday, the president hosted the family of George Floyd to commemorate the somber anniversary of the day Officer Chauvin murdered George Floyd. The images were important, but the Justice in Policing Act, named for Floyd, that Biden had promised to sign by May 25th, is still stalled in the Senate. There were, however, some historic moments in Washington this week. Civil rights attorney Kristen Clark was confirmed to lead the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, making her the first Black woman to serve in that role.
I, Kristen Clark, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And on Wednesday, White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre became the first openly gay woman to lead the White House press briefing and the first Black woman to do so in roughly 30 years.
I appreciate the historic nature, I really do. But I believe that, being behind this podium, being in this room, being in this building is not about one person. It's about, you know, what we do on behalf of the American people. Clearly, the president believes in representation matters, and I appreciate him giving me this opportunity. And it's another reason why I think we are all so proud that this is the most diverse administration in history.
It was a very busy week in the nation's capital, and we're going to start today by walking you through it all. Here with me now is Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, thanks for coming back on the show.
Great to be back.
Also with us is Maya King, politics reporter at Politico. Maya, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Heather, let's start with you. The Biden administration is putting forward a $6 trillion budget. What's in it?
Well, a lot of the stuff we've seen before, so that infrastructure package is a big part of this budget, both the physical infrastructure on the roads and the pipes and getting everyone internet, as well as what they call the CARE package, which would hugely expand affordable child care and elder care and paid parental leave in the United States. There's also a really big increase in what's known as discretionary spending. So the president is proposing a lot of spending on education, research, transitioning the United States to a more climate-friendly economy. So it's about a 16% increase in non-defense spending and a 1.7, so a much more modest increase in defense spending. The big takeaway here is it would be a lot of money next year, in particular a $6 trillion budget and running close to a $2 trillion deficit. So meaning we're not paying from quite a bit of that spending next year. They're painting it, the administration painting it as like a down payment on America's future, getting us on the right track. Obviously, though, there's a lot of concerns about spending money we don't actually have.
Okay, I want to push into one aspect of that. Now, you said they're getting internet for everyone. And I feel like 30 years ago in America, we would have seen states and governors excited about federal spending that would bring that kind of critical infrastructure to their communities. Maya, are we expecting pushback not only in Congress, but also at the state level from governors who would actually benefit from this kind of spending?
Well, it's interesting. I think we can absolutely expect pushback in Congress, and we've already seen that with anything that the Biden administration has put forth that really has a dollar sign attached to it. The immediate response, particularly from Republicans in Congress, has been, this is way too expensive, this will bankrupt the country in the name of liberal policy, and it's just not a viable path forward. And I think we've seen that already in the giant gap. I believe it was last valued at about $1.5 trillion in difference between what Democrats have proposed and what Republicans came back with. Yet on the state level, the need is a little bit different. I think what we saw around the pandemic stimulus payments of the last round, a lot of state and local officials were saying, you know what, we actually really do need this money. And many Republican leaders were willing to accept it there, too. Just because the need is very different and people were really hurting, I think, on the state and local level in a way that governors were able to see much differently. So how this now translates to infrastructure, what this means now for this next round of debate on what exactly infrastructure means, how we define it, and as Heather mentioned, of course, how we pay for it, it certainly, I think, will shape the contours of how different leaders on different levels will respond to it.
Heather. Let's come back to the pay for it piece that Maya ended on there. Maybe this is an indication of why my credit cards look the way they do. But really, who cares if we can't pay for it in the short term? Isn't the real issue here about stoking the economy with this kind of spending and also dealing with all of the deferred maintenance on our national infrastructure?
You make a great point. Obviously, many of the programs that are being proposed are hugely popular, such as paid parental leave, finally getting the United States to have 12 weeks of paid parental leave, making those critical infrastructure investments. Many of us, as you drive around parts of the country, feel those nicks in the road and see those bridges that could really use repair every day, not to mention some of these pipes in the ground. I was on a website recently trying to figure out if the water line to my house is an old lead pipe or not, which is a very scary situation for anyone. And so, but there are costs associated with spending more money than you have, similar to a credit card bill, where if somebody isn't balancing every month, they are paying interest. And the United States is borrowing money from other countries right now in order to fund this, and we are ultimately going to have to pay interest on it. And I think the big concern from an economic perspective is nobody's saying that we're going to hit that critical point where we can't borrow anymore next year or even 5 years. Years down the line, but there is going to be some number that we can't borrow past, or that it becomes much more expensive to borrow, similar to somebody who hasn't paid their credit card bill suddenly sees that interest rate, that borrowing rate, jump up over time. And so that's why there you see, even in the Democratic Party, some voices who are warning, does it really need to be quite this much? I mean, the headline on the New York Times, this front page this morning, is the Biden administration seeking spending levels not seen since World War II. So we are talking about a huge, huge amount of spending, and that's really the debate that's going to come down for a lot of moderate Democrats. They will vote for a number of these programs, but do you vote for it all in one fell swoop, or do you do something that looks a little bit more like, small chunks?
The World War II discourse is instructive here because it is post-World War II America that becomes the global power we understand ourselves to be, in large part because of that spending, and of course also because of the massive war that took us into that space. But Maya, I'm also thinking that in that moment, there was a lot of partisan unity, which is to say that Democrats ran the board at that time. That is not the situation we're in now. These very slim majorities are not what Roosevelt was facing. So is there any possibility that this can, in fact, pass through the government we have right now?
I think you make a great point by mentioning the slim majority here, because even then, that has gotten in the way of Democrats' ability to really push through the agenda that they have in place. And I think really what they'll be reliant upon is reconciliation and sort of bringing in that third party to be able to push through what they really, the terms of this spending that they really do want to see come to fruition. And it's very clear that Democrats, especially in Congress, have gotten much more comfortable with leaving Republicans behind and getting these bills across. Certainly, the American Rescue Plan is, I think, a really good example of that. And the point that the Biden administration has been making is that they're trying really, they consider this point in this time in America, post-pandemic, post-economic downturn, which we're still very much in, as one that would sort of wake up both parties to really the urgency of getting some serious spending passed that hasn't really crystallized yet. But I'm wondering, and what I'm looking for, and especially in my reporting, is whether or not they'll be able to hammer that point home so that they won't have to exactly pull out sort of the nuclear option to get this all through.
So, Heather, in my household, there are there's two big anxieties about what's not in there, right? One is the Medicare age being lowered to 60 is not in there. And for my college age daughter, the $15 minimum wage is not in there. And she's working minimum wage this summer and not happy to see that that is not in there. So why aren't some of those big pieces that we'd heard on the campaign trail, why aren't they in this, you know, enormous package?
Yep, that's an excellent question. I would throw in two more to that list that are kind of surprising that we're on the campaign trail and are not part of this big first budget package. And that is there's no student debt relief or student debt cancellation, even up to that first $10,000 that was talked about a lot in the on the campaign trail. And similar to you mentioned not lowering the Medicare age, also no public option. So on the campaign trail, the president was very adamant about wanting to push some sort of national federal public option for health insurance, and we don't see that in, as part of this as well. The White House keeps saying, and you can that oh, we still support these, that they would be sort of after this 2022 package. These would be the next wave of things, or that they could potentially move simultaneously. I think we've seen that Congress is not good at multitasking. There's a lot here they're already supposed to do with these infrastructure bills that were supposed to be the first one they had hoped would pass by Memorial Day weekend. That hasn't happened. So I think the way I would read this is it's interesting what fell out. When the priorities had to be written on paper, it was interesting what did not make it. And while they're still giving lip service to these items and are still on the dream list for President Biden, I think reality has set in that the Democrats probably only have one or two more big bills that they can pass, and these items do not appear to be on that list.
So let's go here to the other kinds of things that either were or were not happening in D.C. this week. And Maya, this was the moment when we were supposed to have on the president's desk, ready for signature, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, but it didn't happen. Has there been any movement, and is it going to happen?
There has been movement, but our ability to really track or even quantify the progress on this bill has been extremely difficult. We know that Senators Booker, Tim Scott, as well as Representative Karen Bass have been in conversations now for over a month in hammering out the details and trying to come out with some form of a bill, a police reform bill that will make all parties happy. And what that means and what that translates to, particularly to activists, is a much more watered down bill. The big sticking point here is on the policy of qualified immunity, which would, if passed in this bill, allow police officers to be individually sued if they violate someone's personal civil rights. And so that has huge implications for use of force and for officers' engagements with individuals and members of communities, particularly members of the Black community. It gives citizens the opportunity or the legal possibility to actually file suit against individual officers. Republicans have already said pretty much that they're absolutely not in favor of that. They think that it's a bridge too far to make that a part of this national piece of legislation. But I think that Democrats really are trying to pass some version of that that actually allows people to really feel like they have a role in reforming police and reforming policing practices. So whether or not this actually gets passed, we know that time is running out. They really have now about 2 or 3 weeks. I think that Tim Scott said if they don't have a bill on Biden's desk by the middle of June, they will have to sort of recalibrate and realize that this is not perhaps, you know, the path forward on reform. So it certainly remains to be seen. But I think everyone is now looking at this group of lawmakers and kind of encouraging them to hurry up here and really come out with a bill that will make everyone happy.
Oh, it won't make everyone happy, but I get it, right?
Yeah.
So I want to dig in on this for just one more second, Maya, because closely aligned, obviously, to the question of civil rights violations in policing is the much broader set of questions around U.S. civil rights. And we saw Kristen Clark, who I have known and respected for so many years, narrowly win confirmation to lead the Justice Department Civil Rights Division this week. She's going to be the first Black woman in that role. What do you think will be her agenda in the context of the DOJ?
So I think really looking at Clark's record with the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights kind of gives us a really great blueprint for what we could probably expect to see her doing on day one. I think, you know, her work in voting rights was particularly important over the last few years, and that's something where the Civil Rights Division may come in as well. Hate crimes, of course, that was another thing that she was also very instrumental in with the Lawyers Committee that I imagine DOJ in the Civil Rights Division will also be paying a really close attention to. And then, of course, there's the investigation that DOJ has already launched in the pattern of practice investigations of very high-profile police departments, namely the Minneapolis Police Department. I think that as the findings of that investigation start to come out, and really as DOJ really starts to dig in on this and other police departments across the country, we can expect to see Kristen Clark really being the face of those investigations and understanding sort of how police departments across this country have operated that have led to these really high-profile shootings, particularly of African Americans. And a lot of people are waiting to hear and see more about the Minneapolis Police Department in the context of George Floyd's murder. So it'll really be interesting, and I think for a lot of people, very exciting to see Kristen Clark be able to deliver that message and kind of push things forward there.
Absolutely. Heather, let me come to you on another issue, which is actually in the budget, but feels to me like it's connected to these broader questions as well of economic, social, racial justice, and civil rights, and that's housing. And we know that one of the sort of surprising effects of this shutdown, the quarantine, has been just massively rising housing prices around the country. What does the budget plan for affordable housing and assistance from the government around that?
You're absolutely right that there is a lot of reason to be very nervous about the housing market and housing affordability. Even before the pandemic, we had about 11 million families in the United States paying more than half their income on rent. And I think it's likely that that could worsen this summer. Those protections for not getting evicted are set to expire at the end of June. And as you noted, the housing prices have gone up. And at the moment, rent prices are not showing up in the inflation data and the price rising data, but I think there's a high likelihood we could see that happen in the coming months. The plan is very ambitious. It was a big part of that first and second infrastructure package to do several hundred billion dollars more towards affordable housing. That includes building additional affordable housing as well as retrofitting some of the existing housing stock, a lot of which was built in the 50s and 60s and 70s and needs to be desperately upgraded. So, there's definitely a lot here. Whether it will be enough or whether it will move fast enough, even if this were passed this summer, and we talked about the struggles of Congress multitasking, even if this first infrastructure package passes this summer, is that going to be fast enough to alleviate some of these rent concerns or help prevent people from getting evicted right now? I would like to be more optimistic than I am on that.
That one's tough. Maya, on a quick final note, I have to say that I did get more than a little bit of Black girl joy out of watching the historic moment when White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre became the first openly gay woman and the first Black woman in about 30 years to lead the White House press briefing. I mean, was that just the best or what?
Absolutely. And I think that, Black Girl Joy is no small thing. Black women have played a key role in electing this administration. So it's important to also have representation in who's delivering the message out of the White House.
I'm going to take that. I'm going to take Black Girl Joy is no small thing. Maya King is politics reporter at Politico, and Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks so much.